Hello everyone, my name is Pieter Dre and I welcome you to the next episode of our TaxBite podcast. Today I have in my recording studio with me Gilles Fransens. He's an expert in our team monitoring very closely the Pillar 1 developments. Stéphane de Baats, senior counsel, former OECD and monitoring as well very closely these developments around Pillar 1. And since you cannot talk about Pillar 1 without saying something on Pillar 2, I invited also Jean-Philippe Van West, senior counsel and close on the Pillar 2 developments. Now, why have I invited you all in my recording studio? Well, we have seen that the OECD has published a progress report on Pillar 1. After all the developments in the past months on Pillar 2, we would almost forget there is a Pillar 1. No, that's just a joke, of course. But nevertheless, good to recap and refresh our minds. So perhaps we will first have a little of an update before we go in a deep dive from you, Stéphane. Can you just remind us what Pillar 1 is? And then we will talk about who will be impacted and some first reflections, maybe.
Thank you, Pieter, and good day to all of you. What the OECD was actually publishing three documents. There is the progress report, but at the same time, they published frequently asked questions and a fact sheets, including high-level overviews with regard to the amount A rules on the Pillar 1 and a process map for the next steps for applying the amount A rules. It's important to indicate that this is not a consensus document, except for the cover note. And this cover note is actually with regard to Pillar 1, the first consensus document since the October 2021 release on the Pillar 1 and Pillar 2 document. So actually the progress report is a secretariat's note. We all know the origin of this process. It starts with BEPS Action 1, the taxation of the digital economy, but we all know that ever since, it's no longer about the digital economy. We will come back to that in just a minute when we talk about the scope. It's an overlay on transfer pricing, but it is not replacing transfer pricing. So the initial idea was addressing the automated digital services and client-facing businesses, but as indicated, that path was abandoned when the Biden administration in the US came in. Currently, what is targeted are the large multinational enterprises. And when I say large, this means 20 billion of revenue and 10% profitability. The 20 billion of revenue, when Pillar 1 is adopted or can be adopted, that should be reduced to 10 billion after 7 years. There are also some exclusions, some carve-outs, that is extractive industries and regulated financial services, they are excluded. There are also elements with regard to segmentation. At least you can have, if in your IFRS reporting or your US GAAP or other general accepted accounting principles, when you disclose certain segments, but that segment reaches the 20 billion revenue and the 10% profitability, then that segment would also be included, although the multinational as a whole may perhaps not reach the 10% profitability. So the progress report is based on the different building blocks that were open for discussion earlier this year. There were a couple of building blocks, for example, on sourcing and nexus, tax-based determination, the general scope rules, the exclusion for extractive and regulated financial services. So open for public comments. There were two other documents open for public comments that was on tax certainty with regard to amount A and related to amount A, but these are not addressed in this progress report because I think they are too recent. Further to the inclusive framework in October 2021, so there it was already indicated that amount A would be implemented through an multilateral convention. So the inclusive framework, building upon the agreement in 2021, in October 2022, so a year later, they will further this discussion based also on the public comments that they will receive. The inclusive framework anticipate a signing ceremony of the multilateral convention in the first half of 2023, with a possible entry into force in 2024, if a critical mass of countries, and we can think, for example, about the United States, we can think about Switzerland, we can think about Ireland, we can think about Singapore, which in our opinion, can be most contributing, most surrendering states under Amount A. There's also the issue about entry into force if there is a critical mass of countries, but a related question is, when will it enter into application, or when will this convention will have effect? And that will depend, of course, on the signatory countries and when they will enter into application. Certainly in a startup phase, this might lead to certain confusion, for example, differences in assessment years following a calendar year or starting a period on April 1st or even on another date, depending on the accounting period. So confusion might be our share there. The document itself is drafted as an overview of some operative provisions of Amount A. It indicates also some still open issues, so it's not final yet. For example, de minimis profit thresholds, application of other scoping conditions, ongoing work on safe harbor rules. So all these elements are still open for discussion by the inclusive framework, so it's certainly not a final document. It contains a proposed of consolidated version of substantive rules on Amount A, but as indicated, it is not final.
Okay, Stefan, thanks for walking us through the documents that were published. But I didn't hear you say anything on digital service taxes. Does the progress report address these so-called DSTs?
Well, not as such. It does not address DSTs, but it mentions DSTs. So it contains a couple of statements with regard to DSTs. It confirms actually the withdrawal of all existing digital services taxes and similar measures with respect to all companies, so not only the ones in scope of Amount A, but all companies. And the multilateral convention apparently will contain a list of the existing measures. It will also contain a commitment to countries not to enact digital services taxes based on market-based criteria when they are ring-fenced to foreign and foreign-owned businesses and when they are placed outside the income tax system. Now, the question is, of course, what if you don't sign the multilateral convention? Of course, you are free to install a DST. So DSTs as such are not off the table. It's when a country signs the multilateral convention that it should be on the table. But the commitment does not include VAT, transaction taxes, withholding taxes under the tax treaties, or anti-abuse rules, so also there it is not fully off the table. Further work by the inclusive framework will be undertaken on the definitional issues of DSTs, as well as on provisions for the elimination of Amount A allocations for jurisdictions that may impose future measures within scope of this commitment. So okay. Still room for DSTs, I would say.
Okay, yeah, thanks, Stefan. And I, who says Amount A, also thinks about Amount B. And I guess for the audience, a larger part of our audience is probably going to be impacted by Amount B. Amount B addressed, I think, a fixed return for baseline marketing and distribution activities. So can you update us on that one as well, Stefan?
Yes, I can certainly give you an update, but it will be a very brief one because to date, nothing really new has been published. The cover note indicates that good progress has been made and Amount B should be delivered by year end. So okay. We are waiting in anticipation.
So a year end present coming to us.
Okay. Indeed, Peter, okay. Indeed.
Well, Gilles, let's may I perhaps ask you also a question? So let's shift the gears a little bit and let's look at the content of the progress report that was released. Can you enlighten a bit on that, perhaps?
Yeah. Sure, Peter. So as Stefan already mentioned, the report itself has quite a few building blocks. But in summary, what Amount A boils down to is a redistribution of taxing rights. So that means that there's really two core parts of the rules. One part is how can a country receive additional taxing rights? And part two, or a second block, is how can a country then lose taxing rights? And then maybe starting with that first part, so countries which would gain taxing rights under Amount A, there's essentially two steps to consider. So a first step is the initial allocation of Amount A taxing rights. And the way that mechanism would work is that the Amount A, and the way Amount A is calculated, maybe also a brief recap on that. Essentially, the way Amount A is calculated is you look at the profitability of the multinational on a consolidated basis. And you look at, okay, how profitable is that multinational over and above 10%? And 25% of that excess profit is deemed Amount A, essentially. So that Amount A is allocated to jurisdictions pro rata. And revenue is here used as the allocation key for the pro rata split. And this is, well, important to note here is that this is regardless of the existing taxable nexus. So you don't need to have an existing legal entity or permanent establishment in the country. Revenue sourcing, so identifying which revenue can now actually be allocated to a particular jurisdiction, is fairly complex as a topic with different rules for different industries. But at its core, what the rules try to get at is try and trace the revenue to the final point of sale. So looking towards the end consumer, regardless of where the initial sale by the multinational took place, for example, in a B2B context to independent distributors. So if I summarize this step one, you have an Amount A, and that Amount A is allocated pro rata over the revenue earned by the multinational group. Step two then is actually an override mechanism. So once we have our initial allocation of Amount A, there's a potential override. And this is the so-called marketing and distribution safe harbor. What's a bit confusing here is it doesn't really have anything to do with marketing and distribution. What it means is if a multinational has sufficient taxable profit in a jurisdiction already, then the Amount A may be reduced or canceled. And sufficiently profitable here means having a return on depreciation and payroll above 40%. So if your sort of profit before tax divided by depreciation and payroll, if that exceeds 40%, the 40% could also be a higher number depending on the exact facts. But if your profitability exceeds that threshold, if you will, then the Amount A, which is initially allocated to a jurisdiction, is reduced by that excess amount. At its core, Peter, that's the sort of the first step. So how countries could earn, could have additional taxing rights under Amount A.
Jill, let me intervene here. That's interesting because knowing how Pillar 2 is already causing quite some issues to gather the data for multinationals, how feasible is it for multinationals to also gain access to this final customer sales data? Do you think that's feasible at all, Jill?
Well, I think these revenue sourcing rules, as they're called, where the company has to trace the revenue to the end consumer, is extremely challenging for many groups. So let me just give an example here. So imagine that you're a computer chip manufacturer and you sell these computer chips to a manufacturer of fridges, say. That fridge manufacturer then sells its product to a third-party e-commerce platform, which ultimately could sell that fridge anywhere across Europe. Now, what that means is that you, as a chip manufacturer, you have to ask the fridge manufacturer, so your customer, to ask the e-commerce platform, so their customer, to give you the data on where ultimately the fridge is being sold to an end consumer. There's which of course causes quite some complexity in the system, and from a legal perspective, it's not that straightforward on how to get that data. There is a 3-year grace period, which is provided for in the rules. So where during those initial 3 years of the rules being in place, simpler, you know, mechanisms might apply. And there are some exceptions where even after this initial 3 year grace period, you could make use of allocation keys rather than this very complex tracing of revenue. But it's definitely not straightforward to judge whether these exceptions can be applied in a given situation.
Okay, right. Yeah, definitely something to monitor, I think, when the implementation comes closer. Gilles, we discussed about the additional taxation rights that some countries would gain under these rules. What about the other side of the coin, the countries that lose taxation rights?
Yeah, and the way which countries would lose or give up taxing rights, which they have today, is through the so-called surrendering rules. Now, what these rules boil down to is that certain countries will have to give a credit or an exemption for the amount A, which is taxed in a different jurisdiction. So if a multinational has to pay an amount A tax in country X of 10, it means that the multinational would need to gain a credit or an exemption of some sort in country Y, for example. Otherwise, there would be double taxation, which isn't the intention of Pillar 1. Now, to work out which country or which jurisdiction loses taxing right, the progress reports includes a fairly complex mathematical tiering system. And in summary, the way these rules would work is by looking at the profit before tax earned in a jurisdiction divided by payroll and depreciation cost. So similar to the people familiar with Pillar 2, for Pillar 1, we also often look at things and calculations on a sort of jurisdiction basis. So at the end of the day, the countries which have a sufficiently high profitability based on this new ratio, so profit before tax divided by depreciation and payroll, those will be the countries which, you know, are sort of defined as having excess profit and will end up losing taxing rights. And it's quite interesting and important to note here is this return on depreciation and payroll is, of course, pretty new. So it's not a common business metric on how to measure profitability. So this could give some strange results when you know, you would apply this in practice. So for example, imagine that you would have a routine distributor, which I think for most people you would assume is not an entity with an excessive amount of residual profit. That routine distributor might, you know, not be very profitable when its profitability is expressed as a percentage of its revenue. But if you express its profitability as a percentage of its payroll, well, that distributor might be very profitable, and it could end up being one of the jurisdictions which might lose taxing rights due to this new ratio, which is introduced here to calculate profitability.
Okay, thanks, Gilles. Okay, that could lead to some interesting consequences, and thanks for this information. Now, Stefan, we have a progress report. The train is moving forward, so it looks like we're going to have a Pillar 1.
That's a very good question, Peter, but I'm afraid the answer is not so straightforward. Some say that Pillar 1 is dead. Others say that Pillar 1 is on life support, and if you hear people who are drafting at the OECD Inclusive Framework, the report, they say it's alive and kicking. So there is still some turmoil or other turmoil. For example, what will the United States do? Will they sign or not? What will other countries do? What they might look at the impact, for example, a surrendering state. So the impact of amount A on their income. We know that at EU level, the Commission is committed to adopting Pillar 1. We have seen the turmoil related with regard to Pillar 2, first of Poland, who refused to agree or at least adhere to the consensus with regard to Pillar 2. They budged, and now we have Hungary also referring to the pillar package, so the package of pillar one and pillar two combined, so linking the two pillars. The EU has linked politically, not legally, but has politically linked pillar one and pillar two. If there's no pillar one, the road is open for more digital services taxes with, we all know, different scopes, different rates, different provisions, different applications. So this becomes an extremely complex area. And of course, amount A, as Cecile has explained, is extremely complex. So it remains an open question, well, whether we will have a pillar one or pillar two, whether we will have a pillar one even today.
Okay, yeah, thanks Stefan. Yeah, it stays a little bit unclear. I guess if I would be in the audience, that my question would be, what should I do now? Should I take action? Gilles, I think I want to ask you that question. What would you do if you were in the audience?
Yeah, it's an important one. So I guess for those companies who are, you know, falling in the scope as it is laid out right now, so revenue above 20 billion and profitability threshold above 10%. But even those with a revenue threshold above 10 billion, which, you know, over time might also be impacted by these same rules, I see in principle two things that companies can do. So the first thing is you could model, so do some financial modeling to see what the impact of this proposal would be. The second thing you could do is provide comments on the paper, individually as a company or as part of a group of companies, an industry body, what have you. In practice, however, my gut feel is that the return on investment for both those initiatives might be fairly limited at this stage. So if we take the modeling, for example, so contrary to pillar two, the rules aren't final enough to do detailed modeling. And as Stefan outlined, there's still quite a bit of uncertainty. Where I do see some analysis being useful, though, is to make sure that as a group, you have, even at a high level, a view where the key impact might be. And while most groups, they will have quite a good view of what are now their most profitable countries, that picture that might look quite different when you look at it using that return on depreciation and payroll ratio, which might turn out very different results. So doing some high level analysis there to figure that out, that might be useful just to know so that you know where you stand, basically. On the providing comments piece, prior comments which were provided by businesses did have some effect if we look at the revision in the texts, but that impact was also not significant. That being said, though, providing comments on really fundamental topics such as the revenue sourcing, which in its current state might make the rules almost impossible to implement for some groups, those type of comments, they might be worth repeating again and again, really. So that for the companies which are directly affected by Pillar 1, so either under the 20 or the 10 billion threshold. For the other ones, I think it is an area to keep monitoring, given all of the stuff which Stefan mentioned around the alternative of digital service taxes and potentially on the back of that trade wars, etc. Towards the end of the year, there will be, again, as Stefan mentioned, the guidance on amount B, which will be issued. So I think there might be a need for another discussion at that time, because the impact there could be very broad for all companies.
Okay, thanks, Gilles. I'm sure I will invite you back in my recording room here when amount B is coming out. But okay, thanks for that, for sharing your insights in that. The focus in this podcast, and we're getting to the end, unfortunately, was really on pillar one, of course. But Jean-Philippe, you have not been able to say a lot, so I want to ask you about the link between pillar one and pillar two. And I think Stefan already touched on a few aspects on the approval process of pillar two, but I'm sure you can give some more insights to the audience.
Yes, of course, Peter. And over the last, let's say, 10 days, quite some events happened. And let me start with the European Union. And there, Pillar 2 was not voted during the last ECOFIN meeting of July 12th. It was not even on the Pillar 2, it was not even on the formal agenda. However, as you know, since the 1st of July, the Czech took over the presidency from France. And actually, the Czech finance minister said that he is that he will be continue working over summer on Pillar 2 and try to convince Hungary, yeah, which still is the only country now having a veto against Pillar 2, try to convince Hungary and to reach agreement on the next formal ECOFIN meeting, have to obtain the required unanimity, which is scheduled on October 4th. Yeah, so they're working towards October 4th to reach this unanimity. If we see, look at other countries in Europe, they see, of course, there are quite some same voices that say that it's not possible that just one country can block this unanimity, Europe moving forward. And just to give you one idea, that there is, let's say, anyway, amongst politicians, broad support within the EU of Pillar 2 is that, for example, today within Belgium, they're working on a personal income tax reform, and our finance minister Van Peerghem published a blueprint, and there is stated they will introduce a minimum tax for multinational enterprises, clearly showing that it's the intention of at least our finance ministers to continue with Pillar 2. And that's what we hear in other countries within the EU from other EU member states. So that's the European Union. But well, the European Union is not alone, of course. If we look at the US, they're having some issues with Pillar 2, introduction of Pillar 2 there. And there it's mainly with reforming GILTI to align GILTI more with the Pillar 2 model rules and the income inclusion rule. And there's the senator Manchin, who expressed the last week Friday that he cannot support the idea of imposing a minimum tax of 15%. So that, of course, will make it more complicated for the Biden administration to reform GILTI. Not that it will prevent the introduction of Pillar 2 in other countries, such as the EU, but as well Asia or other countries. But that, of course, has important consequences on the interaction between the OECD model rules and the US GILTI rules. And then third, and that's very recent, just today, is actually the UK is moving a step ahead, and it published today draft legislation seeking to implement Pillar 2 into domestic legislation. Although it's only a draft legislation, so it's not the adoption of Pillar 2 rules in the UK yet. It still has to go to Parliament and needs the required majorities ratification. However, for me, if you look at the EU, the Czech presidency saying they want to move forward as well, now the UK publishing draft legislation as well, politicians, ministers, presidents from other countries saying they want to move forward with Pillar 2. For me, this is a clear indication that the question is not if Pillar 2 will be introduced, but that rather the question is when Pillar 2 will be introduced. And my best bet would be that it would be most likely as from 1st January 2024, but that time will tell if this will as well be the time that really countries will implement, or at least a few countries will start with that Pillar 2 will enter into effect within a few countries as from 1st January 2024. So this important, I think, for business is don't think it stops now because there's a few obstacles, but use the time wisely to prepare.
Well, thank you, Jean-Philippe. And with those wise words, I would like to end this podcast. I thank you very much for sharing this with the audience. So Gilles, Jean-Philippe, Stéphane, thanks a lot. For the audience, I thank you for tuning in. If you're going on holidays, I wish you good holidays. If you are returning from holidays, well, then you had good holidays, I hope. If you listen to this during your holidays, enjoy your holidays. And with that, I end this podcast. Thank you very much. Speak to you later.